not talk about Jesus. So the next day, there they are, right back in the temple courts, preaching about Jesus. And the goon squad, the temple police, came in, and the religious leaders came to them and said, "We told you to not ever talk about Jesus again." And Peter said, "Well, you're going to have to judge for yourself whether I should obey you or whether I should obey God. But I'm not going to stop talking about Jesus." So they were arrested again, but because of the fear of the people, they didn't beat them up this time. And then Peter stood up and he made this famous statement in verse 29 of Acts 5. He said, "We must obey God rather than men." I think that is the one exception to this statement here in verse 13, to submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority. The one exception to that is if a human authority asks me or commands me to do something that will cause me to have to disobey God, then God trumps human authority every time. I believe that's really the only exception to what Peter says. It's a big one. Acts 5:29, you might write it in there. We must obey God rather than man. I do think it's interesting that that comes also from Peter's mouth, along with this statement in verse 13. And then it gives some four examples in the parenthetical phrase of verse 14. The emperor as supreme authority, or governors sent by them to punish that whole human authority structure. Interesting that several of the writers in the New Testament said that the idea of authority and even governmental structure is from God. It's been perverted by people, but the idea of it is from God. So why do that? I think verse 15 is the reason. And I think it's an important one, and we'll spend a few minutes on this. Why do that? Well, first, is he says back in verse 13, for the Lord's sake, because you represent him. You're wearing his name. So for his sake. But then verse 15 says, because it is God's will. And the word will has to do with intention and his way. This is God's way of silencing criticisms about his kingdom. It's God's intention and will that by doing good you should silence. That's a rude word. Muzzle or gag. If you look in a dictionary for this word silence, it's to muzzle or gag ill-formed criticisms, ignorant talk of foolish men. It's God's will that by doing good. I want to talk about this. I think Christians have this really mixed up. I know a lot of the church people that I have seen who get press, a lot of them I've seen out here, think that if we're argumentative and arrogant, that we're somehow going to correct people's wrong ideas and their criticisms of Christianity. And my experience has been that that just makes it worse. My flesh fighting against your flesh, the only thing that could possibly win that battle would be flesh, right? And I think Peter is saying that God's way of doing this, of muzzling, silencing, aren't you surprised how many people have no idea what being a Christian is? They're critical. I'm blown away at some of the things that pagans think that Christians believe. If you have a good conversation with them, you go, "Where did you get that? That isn't what we're about at all." Or criticisms that are given, and some of it comes because the devil sees to it that the weirdos get lots of television time, lots of air time. The people that are red-faced and screaming are the ones that get the attention. Satan certainly loves that. God just says, live a good life. Peter says, live the kind of a life that's so like what Jesus is like that it's going to make these people look foolish in their criticism, because they realize that what they're saying isn't true and your life is demonstrating it. Here's a, I have a couple of little rabbit trails on this. One is one that we always forget. God said, my ways are not your ways. So wouldn't that make sense that we should find out God's ways first? Find out what's his way of doing it and then do it that way? And I think this is one of those verses. I'm not sure that I've ever heard a sermon preached on this. But I think this is one of those clues as to God's way of silencing criticism of his people. And it's sure different than the way we are. First of all, we get defensive if we're criticized. Did Jesus? Jesus seemed to have a really pretty thick skin. He didn't waste a lot of energy trying to defend himself against lies and false charges. He just lived a good life. And that's kind of the point of what Peter says in this whole passage. Here's rabbit trail number one. When we are arrogant and disrespectful and scolding and argumentative and elitist to people in the world, we are not following God's methods for combating criticism. It's the human way. It happens in every political system. You see it in junior high school on the playground. It's human. It's just not God's way. I think we get caught in the trap of feeling like we've got to win arguments, and that's why we argue. But can I tell you that our business is not to win arguments? What we want to see is lives changed. We want to see Jesus come into people's lives and change their lives. And I think there's a better shot at that by living a life that demonstrates him than by arguing with somebody to change. Perhaps the best you can do is change their mind and win an argument. I do think there's a place for apologetics, which is the field of defending the faith against, comparing it to false religions and defending the tenets of the faith. I think there's a place for that. My personal feeling, you can take this or leave it. I think we got way too much of that and not enough of the life living part. I think we need more Christians that live the Jesus life. And then I think people will want to listen to our arguments. But I think I don't think apologetics are as needed as we maybe think they are. They're certainly not a substitute for living a good life in front of the world. Ill-formed criticism. I always think of this person that I met when I lived on the island up in Washington, and I talk about her all the time because she was the most talented human I've ever met. I think I mentioned on Sunday she's like the Leonardo da Vinci of our island. She could do anything. The TV dinner woman, where all of the compartments of her life were filled except for the spirituality compartment, and she was just looking for something that she could fit in there nicely, something that wouldn't spill over into anything else. And she was into everything, every New Age thing that you can imagine. And when I first met her, I started buying all the books that I could find on how to talk to New Age people. And I was getting cramps in my brain. But what I noticed was she always rode a bicycle, kept her car on the mainland and rode a bicycle over to the island. And I always took my car. So I'd be sitting in the ferry line waiting, and she would pedal her bike by. And when she would see me, she'd park her bike down on the ferry and come back and stand next to my window. I always have my Bible open. And usually when she came, she was interrupting me. I was talking to the Lord. I was listening to a Bible study tape or reading my Bible, listening to some Christian music. So As soon as she came back, she's a very nice person, attractive woman, so she was very pleasant to be with. But she was always in an interruption to my fellowship that I was having with Jesus. So I'd turn the stuff off. And she'd come and she would chat. And that's how we got to know each other. And I'd run into her everywhere all over town. One morning on my way off the island, she talked to me on the ferry and she said, "Now, I hope you don't think this is weird, but I have been having a lot of trouble in my life. I've been having trouble sleeping." And she said, "Every time I stand next to your car, there's this aura of peace." And she said, 2 o'clock this morning when I couldn't sleep, she said, "I rode my bicycle over to the other side of the island to your house, and I just stood next to your car." And she did this little yoga thing. And I said, "Did you feel any?" I was trying not to laugh because it sounded kind of silly. She was dead serious. And I said, "Did you feel anything?" And she said, "Well, not as much." I said, "Can I tell you something?" I said, "It's not my car." I said, "It's Jesus." And I told her the story. I said, "Every time you come over to talk to me in the ferry line, I'm talking to Jesus. I'm listening to him. I'm hearing music about him. I've got my Bible there. And what you're feeling, that peace that you're feeling that leaks out the doors of my Isuzu Trooper, that's him." And instantly, she turned me off. And she said, "Well, I know all of Jesus's best lines." And she started, and then she just started asking me all of these questions or making all of these statements about what she thought being a Christian was. And I could not believe that's what she thought. Over the course of the next year or so, I remember she was the person who said, "Do you want to be my friend or do you just want to save my soul?" That may be the best question any pagan ever asked me. Because to be honest with you, I didn't know how to answer it. And I said, "Well, okay, I'll be your friend. Yeah, I do want to see your soul saved. I want you to know Jesus. That's the only thing missing from your life that I can see, and he'll change your whole life, but I'll be your friend whether you ever accept him or not." And that started a great friendship, and eventually she wound up giving her life to Jesus. I don't think I ever had a theological discussion with her. I did answer some questions. I did correct some things that she seemed to be misinformed about the Christian life. But the thing that opened up her life to Jesus was something that I couldn't fake and I couldn't argue about. It was his presence. It was real. It was a thing. She had been jumping through every kind of philosophical and religious hoop that there is and never found without drugs. But then with the drugs, then it wore off and you had to do the drugs again. But she found something just by standing next to a car in the ferry line. And I said, "Well, that's leakage. That's Jesus." And that's what I always think of when I think of Peter's exhortation here. Remember, this is Peter who thought he had to protect Jesus at one time in his life. And all he did was cut off an ear. John Corson makes an interesting comment. He said, whenever we think we have to protect Jesus, there's going to be a pile of ears laying around from all the people that we destroy with our swords. I think it's interesting that the very last miracle that Jesus ever did on this earth was to destroy the evidence of Peter's foolishness by picking up that ear and healing it. So I think it's interesting that Peter says, take it from the ear chopper. You don't need to protect Jesus from his enemies and those that foolishly criticize. Just live a life filled with him. And that's what God wants. Live as free men, but don't use your freedom as a cover up for evil. Verse 16. Instead, He says, live as servants of God. That's another one of those ponderables, I think, that you could, if you're a thinker, if you sit and think, if you have time to sit and think, or I know in the bathroom or before you fall asleep, I don't know, wherever your good thinking spots are. For me, it's usually when I'm driving. What does it mean to live as a servant of God? Well, I can tell you what it really means. It's not just the title that you wear. It means that I'm his property. I belong to him. I live my life like I don't belong to me. It means that I'm living my life as he wishes and as he directs. You can't be somebody's servant long distance. Not in the sense, at least, of what this word means. So each moment, living as he directs and as he wishes. And of course, you can't do that without him there. And of course, that's what he wants anyway. I always think of Ruthie, my friend Ruthie Burke, and her 7 children. And when I met this family, she had 7 children under the age of 6. Just wrap your brain around that. It was pandemonium in that house. She wanted 3 or 4 more children, but they couldn't have any more. But the thing that she always did when she was trying to give instructions to one of the children, she would say, look at my face. If you look at my face, then I know you're listening to me. Because, you know, you could be shouting and the pandemonium and the kids are looking everywhere. And she said, look at my face, Jacob. Look at my face, Callie. And they look at her face. And that's what I always think of Jesus as saying to me when he wants me to be his servant. He says, Bob, look at my face. Fix your attention on me and you'll be okay. And if something is you're doing, if you're headed the wrong direction, you're about to make a bad decision, all I have to do is just wince and you'll see it. So that's what it means to live as servants of God. Verse 17, my NIV says, proper respect to everyone. I do want to talk about this for a minute. I actually have a couple of rabbit trails on this too. The word that's translated proper respect here, the Greek word has to do with valuing people. Thinking of people as being valuable. I do find this kind of interesting how this fits in with the parable of the Good Samaritan that we talked about on Sunday. Because the point that Jesus was making in that parable, remember, here's this guy beat up and half dead off to the side of the road that was notorious for robbers. And the first 2 people to pass by were religious professionals. And when they saw the guy, they passed by on the other side of the road like he was a pile of dog poop or something, like he wasn't even a human. Didn't deserve their attention. The Samaritan stopped and saw this is an injured human. And because he valued this wreckage as a person, he did what he did. I think this show proper respect to everyone thing is very often disobeyed by church people. I struggle with it myself. I struggle with it when I'm in a really bad mood about the way people are acting. I don't want to be around people like that. You know, I'm trying to live the kind of a life that's pleasing to God, and there's certain people's behavior and condition that is so repulsive or so foreign, and you know what I'm saying? That you have to grab your brain and force yourself to see that they're people. They're valuable. They're valuable to him. And if they're valuable to him, they should be valuable to me. This is one of those things I can't do without help. I can show proper honor and value certain people. And then other people, I feel repulsed by them. That's not right. Don't you love to watch Jesus? I look at Jesus and I see the way he treated people who were so repulsive and did such repulsive things that nobody wanted to be around them. Look at the way he treated them. He always treated them with respect. That's why I love that Greek word, gune, that word for precious woman, that Jesus addressed those seven women in Scripture with this word, because all of them were women with bad reputations, in some way looked down upon, and some of them it was undeserved, and some of them it was because of the kind of life that they lived. None of them, probably most of them, had never been spoken to with respect by a holy man. Some of them probably never been valued by any man. The woman at the well, she'd been married five times and finally gave up on even tying the knot because it wasn't worth the effort. But it's characteristic to look at Jesus that he always treated these people, and people who looked repulsive and people who acted in repulsive ways, every contact you see Jesus have with them, he always treated them like they were valuable. Why do you suppose that was? It's an important answer. Because they were. To him, they were valuable. I have to tell you, I do struggle with this. I have found the solution to it. This is kind of where the whole hating the sinner instead of hating the sin thing comes from. You know how church people can be? We hate people because of the sin instead of loving the people and hating the sin. And the reason why God hates the sin is because he values the people and because of what sin does to them. And we just don't think that way. We just see a sinner and we hate the sinner. And God does not. Here's the solution. I just have to ask him to help me to see people the way that he sees them. And once again, you have to stay close to do that. I am always misjudging people. Jesus said an interesting thing. He said, I don't judge anybody except as I hear from my Heavenly Father. I think, wow, would my life be different if before I just jumped to a judgment about somebody, I ran it by Dad first. Father and I had a little talk, and I said, okay, what do you think about this person? The answer might surprise me. That's rabbit trail number one. Rabbit trail number two is one of the ways that I know to best respect people is to respect and honor their boundaries. And once again, church people, and especially ones that I've met out here, are pushy. They're constantly violating people's personal space in the name of God. They're in your face. And that's disrespectful. That's saying, you are not important enough for me to stay out of your space. And you know what I mean? There is a fine line between enthusiasm and pushiness. And it's possible to step over the line just because you're enthusiastic. But I tell you, the way that you know whether you're a boundary respecter or not is the minute you get a vibe from somebody that you just walked into, you stepped over the line, do you back off? Or do you just keep pounding? Do you just keep going? Or do you notice at all? And I, like I said, been there, done that. Had it done to me. I hate it when it's done to me. So the solution that I know is just be sensitive and prayerful. Once again, run it by Father. Say, Lord, make me sensitive to your Spirit, because you know when I'm being pushy. So that's all wrapped up in that phrase, show the proper respect, honor, value to everybody. Why in the world would God ask us to do that? could it really be that it's because he does?